Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisquintas.
That particular Donna Prisquintas. This is the Donalana Kitchen. Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery and Ames. Community-owned, community-focused since 1974. Open daily, 7 to 9. Located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op. Well, a lovely winter week. The chickadees are singing. That does mean, really truly, that spring is on its way. They're making their chick-dee, chick-dee. And that doesn't happen in January and December. The chickadees just kind of hang out at the bird feeder and look cold. Now they're starting to do their chick-dee, chick-dee. And my hope is that spring is on its way. We're going to be discussing a little bit about the pipeline update.
Yeah. We're going to have our bummer report here.
Well, that's all right. There's things going on outside of our kitchen window, and
that's
maybe
right.
In your very own backyard. There has been a big debate, but there has also been a great surge forward of things going on with this Bakken pipeline that's going to cut diagonally from the northeast to the southwest of the state of Iowa.
Yes, it certainly has stirred up a lot of conversation, a lot of information, I think a good, strong, healthy public dialogue, no matter what comes of it. Of course, I have my own personal inclinations, but I'm really, really pleased and heartened by the amount of public dialogue that we've had about it.
Yes, it is. Everybody has an opinion. That's a real good thing. We ought to talk to each other more often. So we're going to be discussing our changing Iowa landscape. There's things that happen. And look out our back window, and there it is. So let's talk about that today. But first, we have a news item from the Donalana Kitchen News Department. We have tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-tick-tick-tick-tick-tick-tick. There's our news item again. I ran across this news item in the Ames Tribune, and just like Will Rogers, everything I know, I find out in the paper. And this caught my eye last week, and it kind of connects food with our need and desire for lots of oil. The title of this article is "Lower Gas Prices Have Increased Convenience Store Snacking."
Ooh, this does not sound like it's a positive outcome.
Well, there's good, there's bad, there's good and bad. Nationwide, gas prices plunged in the second half of last year as fracking boosted U.S. shale oil production and OPEC oil cartel kept spigot open. Increasingly, experts say drivers are taking the windfall saved at the pump and spending it inside the nearest convenience store. Aren't we a great species?
I guess it depends on what you're spending it on.
Okay,
you know?
Okay. Because profit margins on a gallon of gas are so thin, sales of drinks and of fast food merchandise are much more profitable for a convenience store owner than fuel sales. And I think we've known that for a long time. Convenience store grocery folks make their money off of them chips and them ding-dongs and those big Slurpees they're selling. Okay? But lately, surprisingly, there's been studies. People study everything. It's the beverage sales that you see mostly increasing, and other items too. But mainly, it's the beverage sales that have gone up. So
which kind of beverage sales?
Well, it is. Although they do sell beer and other things there, it's mainly the non-alcoholic beverages gained nearly
SODA.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Nearly 6% in the fourth quarter of 2014 compared with the year earlier. And the third quarter, there was a 6.2% gain.
Okay, now does that mean because the gas prices are going down, we're going to increase the obesity epidemic?
There might be.
That would be less walking and more soda. Ooh.
Well, there's something going on here. People feel like it's a good thing. It must be a good thing that prices are going down. Oil, that's good. So we have more money, and what do we do? buy ourselves a big Slurpee cup there. And that's what's going on. And surprisingly, of all gas purchased by consumers in the U.S., roughly 80% comes from those convenience store pumps. Only 10% of the sales come from traditional services, and the other 10% comes from,
wow,
from big box stores and the gas stations that are connected to groceries and things like that. That's a lot. So people are there, and there's all these fast foody things inside. So I suppose it's good for the convenience store owners. They're getting a little bit profit.
Oh, see, I've always been in the wrong business.
See, I know here. So another thought about food here. So it does make the economy better, right? Right? When you don't have to worry about gas prices going up and down. Now, that's a convenience store owner talking. A person coming out of the convenience store with his hands full of stuff says, oh, this is good, this is good. Quote, it allows you to get snacks when you're hungry. Now you can pick up maybe just $7 worth of gas and use the rest to pick up some beef jerky or Snickers or something. So there.
Beef jerky, okay. That's so, better for the old insulin levels.
A little thought about our economy, how we buy things.
Well, another news item to counterbalance this one.
Yes.
It's a recommendation. It's not an actual fact. Well, it's based on science, but I don't know. One of the large Washington, D.C., you know, public policy dietetics associations are one of those big groups that kind of lays down the underpinnings for the American dietary guidelines. And this is just the beginning of the process. We'll get another pyramid or circle or three-legged stool or something like that in the next couple of years. But the basis of it comes from often these recommendations. So this week, the recommendations were issued. And guess what Americans are supposed to do?
I have no idea.
You're supposed to drink more coffee and eat less meat.
More coffee?
Well, that's the quick and dirty take that anybody will get. They've revised their opinions on caffeine. I'm not sure I agree personally. And they've reduced meat and sugars, much to the outcry of the meat industry and the sugar lobby. But there you have it. They have stood up to those voices because the science is very sound that we do need to eat a little less meat. A little. Anyway, everybody can reduce a little bit. And, of course, we all need to eat less white sugar. So, and, of course, the one of the meat lobbies said, there's no science behind that. Well, there's no accounting for taste.
See?
And there's no accounting for science. Oh, my goodness. Anyway.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's some of the news.
Well, and here's another instance of the fact that bad for some, good for the other. The meat lobby may be complaining, but the coffee folks probably are going to be smiling. So
that's right.
It's
please all of the folks all of the time or something like that.
It's always a good day for somebody. We have a special guest in our studio.
Yes, we do. I want to introduce Taylor Brorby, who is living in Iowa now because he is a student in the master's degree, MFA program in creative writing and the environment at ISU. Taylor already has one master's degree. He wants to get another one. And he is originally from North Dakota, and his area of expertise and interest in writing has to do with the Bakken oil area because he's from that area. And I have to say I'm really drawn to Taylor's work because he talks about kind of the heartbreak that he's experienced by having the area where he grew up, and he will wax eloquently about this in a few minutes. But I want to say I lived away from this area. I actually grew up in Western Illinois, which is very similar to here in a lot of ways. But I lived mostly on the East or West Coast for 40 years, I always say. Well, I wandered in the desert for 40 years. And then when I came back, the changes for me were heartbreaking because I couldn't, you know, as a child, you could swim in any old creek or pond or this or that. And I'm an avid swimmer, so you can't, like, would you want to go swimming in the Skunk River, Lana?
No, probably not.
I know. I'm even a little frightened when my dog goes in the river. And then, you know, the changes of the fences are down and the animals are gone, at least visually. These kinds of changes are They're wrenching for us old folks.
They're shocking. My big shock was moving to Iowa about 30 years ago. And at that time, you couldn't buy beer on Sunday here.
She's speaking as a Wisconsinite.
But that's changed. Things do get better. But back to our idea of changing landscapes.
Right. So, Taylor, tell us about the area in North Dakota that is now the Bakken and how it was. Taylor's only 27, but his childhood was long enough ago that these changes were not there. Do tell us, Taylor.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me, Donna and Lana, on your radio program. So western North Dakota, where the Bakken oil boom is, basically extends from Dickinson along Interstate 94 all the way to the Montana border and then north up to Canada and as far east as Minot. It's sort of...
So is this kind of the whole northwestern quarter of the state, basically?
Yeah, it is about a quarter of the state is where this oil development
is happening. North Dakota's roughly rectangular, you can get a visual on that.
Right, right, exactly. This all happens around the Missouri River, Lake Sakakawea watershed, which Lake Sakakawea is the second major reservoir on the Missouri River.
Well, and
channel.
The Missouri River is an Iowa river as well, everybody, so listen up.
Exactly.
We're getting the downstream from it.
And so my childhood, my upbringing was actually, I grew up in coal country, just a little bit east of where the Bakken oil boom is currently happening, but we would vacation and travel all throughout western North Dakota, and my parents actually currently live on Lake Sakakawea. North Dakota's had two previous oil booms, one in the late 40s, early 50s, and then the more recent of the three happened in the late 70s and early 80s. But this technology, horizontal drilling, hydraulic fracturing, did not exist. Hydraulic fracturing has been around since the late 40s, but with the advent of this engineering technique, this little device called a whipstock, it bends pipe over several hundred feet to allow it to go horizontally into the shale oil.
Some genius engineers.
Who probably, owns half of Bermuda now or something. And so what that allows is instead of just hitting a pocket of oil, you can actually drill into the level where the oil resides. So this has allowed us to expand oil development in the state to a huge amount. There are currently about 11,000 oil-producing wells. You can actually see North Dakota from outer space at night because we're also flaring natural gas. So,
wait, explain the flaring of the natural gas. Oh. This is just mind-blowing.
So, your listeners...
I mean, I pay a gas bill.
Right, right.
It ain't cheap, right?
So your listeners probably know we're also fracking in Pennsylvania in the Marcellus Shale area, and that's for natural gas. But in North Dakota, we're fracking for – don't you love that word, fracking? It's like
funny.
A wonderful F word. But it's a process where we're drilling for oil primarily, but natural gas is, of course, a byproduct because over 400 million years, dinosaurs have died, plants have died. They get crushed and pulverized and make this incredible energy resource that we're now using to such a large extent. But there's also natural gas at this level. North Dakota has not implemented a policy that demands that you capture 100% of natural gas. So the gas actually to release it, the stuff that isn't captured is siphoned off through a pipe where it's actually lit on fire.
And that means it's a throwaway.
Right. It means we're burning roughly about $70 to $100 million.
It's cheaper to burn it than to save it.
Right now,
and use it and sell it. Unbelievable.
How economics works is that the current price of oil is so much more valuable in terms of cost, in terms of monetary gain, that it's more efficient for us to burn the natural gas because oil is about 13 times more valuable than natural gas than to capture it.
And sell it.
So we can afford to burn off anywhere from $700 million to $1.2 billion in a year and still come out well ahead. So for listeners out there, if you would Google the country at night, you can see this patch sort of in the Midwest, just up from where Minneapolis is giving its light pollution. You can see western North Dakota, but instead of a city light, it's actually the Earth's largest bonfire. It looks like You know, you hear about the Lake of Fire in the Book of Revelation, but that looks like a pleasant summer cruise compared to Western North Dakota. So these flares, you know, they can be anything from a few feet high to over 20 feet. It's really remarkable and haunting.
Well, speaking of haunting and flares, just recently in the news, the train derailment in West Virginia. Oh. This was also moving petroleum products by a sort
and
of long,
and haunting,
skinny thing.
The photographs and, I've seen.
Whew. Yes, scary, and yes, the stuff burns. Yes, the stuff is dangerous. And whether it comes through Iowa on a new pipeline or whether it comes through Iowa on a train, things still burn.
Correct. And I think, too, with what you're saying, too, Lana, is we know this product is volatile. And this product
and toxic.
Last month, a pipeline spilled near Glendive, Montana, right under the Yellowstone River. It took us about an hour to shut down the valve. It released about, reports are saying, 30,000 gallons. The city of Glendive had to shut down its drinking water because of the oil that comes from the Bakken has a known cancer-causing agent, benzene. And so this went right into a town of 6,000's water supply. Oil's being reported.
And how would one get rid of that?
So right now, well, the disadvantage is the Yellowstone River is actually frozen. So the oil is under the ice, has actually been trapped in the ice. So we'll be seeing this play out throughout this spring. But it's been able to go underneath the ice and reach as far downstream as Williston, North Dakota, which effectively means it's entered the Missouri River watershed. So that
it's going to be visiting the shores of Iowa.
And there are fish. I just read a morning report that still the fisheries in Montana are advising not to catch and eat fish in the Yellowstone River because there's petroleum bases in their mussels. So it creates a whole slew of energy issues. We have things like the train, certainly, and pipeline issues as well to be considering about what's happening in Iowa. Certainly those oil trains come through Ames every day. I mean, I can point them out to you. The trains that derailed in West Virginia actually were the more impact-resistant type.
Right, they were the better.
Supposedly
really?
Better.
Yes,
and
yes.
Still,
the new and improved version. Kabam!
And if you haven't seen the images, I mean, it looks like an atom bomb went off this huge mushroom cloud. And today the New York Times had released an article about saying what would happen if that derailment happened in Rochester, New York. You know, and the Minneapolis Star Tribune has been raising similar questions about this as well.
Right. Fortunately, that one in Virginia was in a fairly unpopulated area.
Right, right. There's
of course,
still
it went
houses.
In their river, too.
Right, right. Yep. They were not able to drink, and the river was actually on fire for a number of days from the oil continuing to leach and leak. But, you know, trains are certainly dangerous, but pipelines also don't ensure any type of safe traffic of this oil. The pipeline would enter the state right near Sioux City in the northwest corner and then go to the southeast corner. And it actually passed through here in Story County and get very close to some of Iowa State's research plots as well. But some of the questions I have and ones that haven't been answered in North Dakota is how does Iowa prepare for when an oil spill happens? Because the town of Glendive, that pipeline was about 60 years old, which if this pipeline's built, it'll undoubtedly get old. It won't be maintained to the level it will be right when it's first built. But what happens if that spills in Des Moines drinking water?
You know, I went to the meeting in Boone where the representatives from the company that want to build the pipeline were asked that question. And he said something like, well, first of all, the security is we do some kind of aerial surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I don't know how close they're going to dive down and inspect this pipeline. But, you know, if there's a leak, it could go on a long time before they notice it from up there. Then they said they have shut off valves. I've forgotten how many he said in the state, but it was not a large number, which mm-hmm. means even by the time they find a leak, then they shut it off, it's still going to leak for a while. Then the most upsetting thing was their responders are sounded so far away and so sparse that basically it will, like if we had a leak in Ames, it would be our fire department and mostly our fire department, but, you know, all of our public responders would have the responsibility for dealing with it. My question is, of course, they're trained to some degree, but this is a monumental possibility. And, of course, who pays? The taxpayers,
you know. And so, I mean, like an example I would lift up was in 2013 in September, a farmer, Steve Jensen, had a pipeline by Tesoro leak on his
property
in North Dakota, near Tioga, North Dakota, which is in between Minot and Williston. And the pipeline leaked, and the public wasn't notified until 10 days after the leak. But it's the largest inland oil spill in the country.
It took the farmer himself
to go out into his cropland. So what happened was 865,200 gallons of oil had spilled, and he had his tractor out, and he came back to his property, you know, back to his house, and noticed that there was oil on the tires, and then figured out who the pipeline was through and called them, and they said they actually had a leak and that he was informing them that there was a leak. And the reports that Tesoro put out said the hole was only as big as a quarter. But mathematicians in the state said for that amount of oil to leak that much, it would have taken 8 to 9 months, which I don't know any farmer who doesn't visit certain areas of his or her property for 8 to 9 months.
The size of a quarter. Oh, that's astounding.
So the size of that spill, that many gallons, is about 7 football fields is what it looks like. And we're still in phase one of remediation. I mean,
so what happens to that farmer's land then?
Right now he's basically holding quiet because Tesoro, of course, is courting them, I'm sure, with several million dollars. They haven't publicly done an outcry against Tesoro. So things like this, there are ways to...
But it's unfarmable.
It's unfarmable during his life. Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, of the two types of spills, we'd prefer there are oil spills compared to saltwater spills, because saltwater soaks in quicker and renders land sterile.
And saltwater is used a lot in fracking.
Correct.
Right?
Yep, it is. Yep, the saliency of the water is about 10 to 13 times as salty as the ocean. So I came to your house with your potted plant and poured a cup of fracking fluid into it, your plant would die and that soil would be untillable. But oil spills,
maybe
of course.
Maybe we can use it instead of glyphosate.
In moderation.
Oh. In moderation. Exactly.
We can have some GMOs that are salt tolerant.
Right.
We may need them.
Gosh, now you're going to give people ideas.
But the other thing, too, we're seeing is that numerous pipelines leak in North Dakota. I mean, over the course of this boom, the amount of oil, chemical, and saltwater spills is about 9,000 reported spills. So that's a lowball figure. It's probably several thousand more than that. But part of this pipeline is that it would cross 8 major watersheds in Iowa.
In the Iowa pipeline.
Yeah.
Carrying the Bakken oil.
Right.
Oh, you're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Support this program. We're talking about our changing landscape.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to our special guest, Taylor Brewery, about our changing Iowa landscape because he's watched the landscape change in his home state of North Dakota. We're talking about the Bakken Pipeline. It may be on folks' mind now. They a lot of talk about it before Christmas, and now it's kind of into the legal stages. There's still things that can be done, things that can be...
still in progress.
Yeah, still in progress. So,
Taylor, tell us a little bit more about what the landscape was like before the Bakken, and now it looks like a ring of fire. But.
Sure. So you can see it not only from space, but down on the ground when you're driving as well. There are obviously changes, impacts to infrastructure. And
can you smell it?
There have been times where I've been driving, you can actually smell propane burning as well, just because of certain chemicals that are added to the flares.
And what does flaring off all of that gas do on that scale?
It continues pushing global climate change. I mean, that's really what we're seeing. It would increase anyone who has respiratory issues. It would be hard on their system as well.
Gee, not many of us have respiratory issues.
So there's a risk to public health in the region as well. But there's also the aesthetic change as well. There are beautiful buttes and bluffs in western North Dakota, part of the Badlands, that took millions of years to form.
There's a lot of tribal areas up there,
tribal
too,
land,
right?
As well. Yeah, and these buttes and bluffs can basically be decapitated in a day, and a pump jack will be put on them, depending on where the farmer's section starts. And normally, since we drill horizontally, you'll begin oil development on the corner of someone's land so it can reach through as much of it as possible, because the pipe can go 2 miles horizontally as well. So it's not only seeing an image from space, it's also seeing certain geological formations that are just, they're never coming back. You know, we'll never see them again. There are other risks too, not only to wildlife. Like a farmer I had interviewed this past summer, the godwits no longer nest where she lives because of so much flaring. And her question was, well, if the godwits
What are godwits?
Just little beautiful birds.
Are they like our chickadees?
They're similar chickadees, but no longer nest there. The spills that have happened in the Missouri River and Yellowstone River, also where the pallid sturgeon live, which is an endangered species.
Oh, talk about the pallid sturgeon. You wrote a wonderful article. Where was it? In Huffington Post or something?
It was in this called the Ecological Theological Review. And
the pallid sturgeon. Tell us what a pallid sturgeon is.
So it's a fish that came out of a time period, the Cretaceous, 70 million years ago, which, to give you an idea, is when Triceratops and Tyrannosaurus Rex.
So it's kind of primitive looking.
It's very, it has
worse
more,
than a catfish, I
yes,
bet.
Yes, and sturdier too. It's made up of planks of cartilage. It's sort of the river janitor.
Am I thinking of a dinosaur fish maybe or something?
Yeah, I mean, it
a
has
river
a tail.
Janitor.
A tail similar to a shark. It's a heterospherical tail.
How big are they?
They can get up to 4 feet long.
Wow.
And they have this sort of vacuum cleaner mouth where they slurp up roots or small fish as well.
And so you saw these as children?
Yeah,
as a child.
I mean, if you would accidentally...
This would be impressive as a child, as an adult even. Mm-hmm.
If you accidentally would catch one, you have to let it go right away because they're predicted to go extinct by 2018.
Wow.
So the impact of oil development with these spills is right in the habitat of where these creatures live. You know, this, of course, doesn't get many people fired up politically. It sort of pulls really at what I understand this region to look like and things that are important to me. The sage grouse, as well, is predicted to be extinct from the state in the coming years.
It's a variety of grouse?
It is, yep. And they do this beautiful courtship dance in the spring. They're sort of like prairie chickens in this way.
Uh-huh.
And once they have these drumming circles called leks, where the males will present and parade around. But if a lek is developed, sage grouse aren't smart enough to just move it someplace else, so they leave. Their population declines. So because of the impact of oil development, things like this are also happening, which we're not really talking about because we like our lower gas prices, or that's what we like to believe. But the lowering in gas prices isn't actually from the Bakken oil boom or developing oil in this country. It's because Saudi Arabia is flooding the market. The Saudis are really showing who's in control here.
Well, just a little explanation is that the kind of oil drilling that they do in Saudi Arabia is, we can call it traditional. You know, they just pump it right out. They don't have to frack. So getting it out is far less expensive for them than it is for fracking. So the price of oil is going up and up and up and up. And this is one of the things or the causations that made fracking more financially viable, because the higher the price of gasoline, what was $100, $120 a barrel for a while, and fracked oil costs about how much to make?
Low estimates are something around $20 a barrel or so. I mean, the profit margins are huge.
But on fracked oil.
Oh, fracked oil, it is much higher. Yeah, it is.
The Saudi Arabian oil can go down to 30 or
not. And they can still be treating
an adequate
profit.
And they can still be making money.
Yeah, that's correct. That is correct.
But fracked oil is maybe double that?
I would say it's around that, just due to the intensity of the procedure, the depth we have to go to. Even though we believe North Dakota and Texas have great quantities of oil, wells are not as efficient as they are in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia only loses about 5% efficiency per year. So after year one, you drop to 95%, then to 90. The Bakken tends to drop by 15% within the first year, and then it can be reduced as much as half by the second.
Well, with oil prices where they are right now, isn't it actually almost below the cost of Bakken production?
Right now, we're seeing that companies such as Halliburton are laying off a large amount of people up in the area. So there's this double-edged sword to it. You know, no one I don't like when people have to struggle for employment or whatnot. But we're seeing that a bust potentially could be coming if oil prices stay this low. Economists are saying if oil stays at this price for more than 6 months.
And no one has any idea how long this will go on.
That's
absolutely
correct.
I mean, you can read the financial press, because, boy, are they paying attention. Nobody knows.
Right.
Even the Saudis don't know where this will go.
And we're seeing, too, I think now in Iowa especially, just sort of a shift in our development of oil. We're planning to keep it going for a while, but this pipeline, too, like Carolyn Raffensperger, who lives in town here, has a theory, and it seems to actually be proving itself, that since Keystone is such a controversial pipeline right now and being threatened to be held up in Nebraska courts, that this is actually what she calls Keystone Light, not like the beer, but a different version of the pipeline. And what we're seeing is that this pipeline in Iowa would come directly from the Bakken and connect over in Patoka, Illinois, where an existing pipeline structure is in place to connect it to the Gulf of Mexico. The other week, when I was traveling down to Central College, there's actually a Canadian company that has applied for a permit to build a pipeline from the Bakken up into Canada. It's about a $600 million project. And Carolyn's theory, and so far it seems that it would be correct, is that
she usually does her homework.
These pipelines would then connect, and it would be very easy once this permit is approved to build a pipeline from North Dakota into Canada to go into the tar sands.
So essentially what Carolyn is saying is that the oil industry, in its infinite wisdom and all-seeing eyes, has realized that maybe Keystone is going to be a stumbling block. So this is plan B. We don't need Keystone anymore. We'll just go through Iowa and several other places. And maybe if we break it down smaller, no one will notice.
Right. And right now, too, I mean, as you both know, the Iowa Utilities Board, this triumvirate, is really the governing body to see if this pipeline comes through. And it's actually the open comment period on this pipeline. So your listeners
go. Citizen voice, time to speak up.
And make their thoughts and opinions heard. And the Iowa Utilities Board will, you know, peruse these comments. But easy way for listeners to find how to do that is to visit nobakken.com. And there is a link to
take
them.
It's our website for the Iowa issues. Mm-hmm. And do go take a read. It's actually very interesting to break it down and learn how these processes come about right under our noses. And really, it's our job as citizens to, you know, be aware. If we don't take action now and it turns out to be a really, really rough patch, we probably have no one but ourselves to blame.
Right, right.
Passive citizenry.
And so it's just the easy thing to do. Like I was telling them at Central College, you can all have a coffee date and, you know, send your comments into the IUB to make your voices heard. And this is really the one instance where the voices of Iowans will be taken into account for this pipeline.
Taylor, say the where's the Bakken Pipeline Resistance? What's the URL?
It should be nobakken.com, I believe.
It's nobakken.com.
Nobakken.com.
Yep, yeah.
And that's Bakken is B-A-K-K-E-N.
Correct.
Because if you don't spell it right, you won't find the website.
That's right. And there's a nice little link that users can click to then go to submit their comments at the IUB. It's an easy thing to do while you're having your morning cup of coffee.
And also it lists kind of where we are in the process. It talks about what some of the issues are on this website and also when there are public meetings about it and, you know, where to get more information. And especially it's been, I think, a huge burden for the landowners that actually own the land that the pipeline is going to go through. I mean, I personally wouldn't want to have to make those decisions. This is what, you know, you go, well, they're going to pay the farmers, but what they're paying for, and they say, oh, and we'll use current land values, but they're paying for this sort of, I don't know, like 50-foot strip down some place of your land and not the rest of it. And so that's really not that much land, but I think the risk to the landowner increases.
And all of us.
Yes. You know, I mean, if I were going to buy a piece of farmland and it had a pipeline running through it, I think I maybe wouldn't buy it because that's like, I don't want that liability. I don't want to have to watch for a quarter-sized leaking hole that leaks 8 football fields into my farm one day.
When we were informed of this project last year and there were community meetings and there was talk about the benefits of the pipeline. After all, I mean, this is going to be jobs and the farmers are going to have a good time because they'll have this income off of their land. And as we learn more and more. For a couple of years.
Yeah,
we learn more and more that maybe this pipeline, even if it's built, the economics of producing stuff to go through it may just kind of piddle out with the cost of fracking and everything. So here we may have a pipeline. So whose responsibility is that? Putting in this big pipeline, it's here forever unless the farmer wants to go out and build and dig it up himself.
But and properly dispose of it.
Here it is. I read someplace that there's an estimated 7 years worth of oil in the Bakken region. Is that true? Is that 7 years worth of at least economically viable
full production.
And what the industry is sort of purporting, Harold Hamm especially, who's the CEO of Continental Resources, the largest player in the Bakken, who'll actually be in Pella, Iowa this week speaking at Central College on Thursday. What he's predicting and what industry would want us to believe is that there's 30 to 40 years worth of oil in the Bakken. But right now we're producing over 1.1 million barrels a day, and Harold would like it to go up to 2 million. And so you're seeing more of an investment in infrastructure, which to my mind is very 20th century, and we live in the 21st century.
Give me an electric car soon. Soon, please.
Soon. And so things like this, I think, Di, you're right with
a solar-powered electric car. How about that?
That would be wonderful.
Or wind-powered.
Right, exactly. But with the focus on landowners especially, it's like isolating one member in a team sport. It makes everybody weaker. And we're seeing that with Iowa, right? Like this isn't as big as Keystone. So it becomes a conversation just for Iowa when really this should be a national conversation. Do we want to be investing in an infrastructure that we know is systematically bringing about some of the worst changes we're seeing on the planet? Do we want farmers to have to worry about if their cropland is going to be able to survive an oil spill, which, of course, it will not? But it also creates tension between neighbors in conversation. if Farmer Johnson is okay with the pipeline going through his land, but Farmer Erickson doesn't want it, what does that mean? And what does that mean for good neighbors? What does it also mean if it comes through Story County and a leak happens here, but the Des Moines water supply is compromised because of that?
Or the everybody else's water supply.
Exactly.
We're on top of some pretty good water here, at least the stuff
Ames,
you drill down for. And so the pipeline, we like to think it's not in my backyard, but this is our backyard, folks.
And this is our we have our own aquifer here.
We're crossing two of the major water highways of the continent if this pipeline comes through, too, which you know, the great writer Wendell Berry would often remind us, be kind to those people who live upstream from you. But right now, North Dakota is not being kind to the rest of the nation in terms of the amount of spills. But this would be a systematic investment in that continued old model, which I really think time is not on our side, and we need to be investing in some better practices of how we power ourselves.
Well, especially here in Iowa, we've done very well as a state with wind energy in terms of jobs, in terms of manufacturing wind turbines, and putting a lot up. You know, we as a state have some good experience, very positive experience with alternative energy, not to mention the whole ethanol thing, which has its ups and downs as well. But we are a state that has already moved forward to a lot of alternative energy and looking at it and living with it. And so this is really, really retro, as you keep saying. You call it a 20th century technology.
And I think, too, just to sort of broaden that, too, is to also think about what role does government play in the state? And is this in the best interest of every resident of Iowa? I mean, we're cutting across the state in such an incredible way. It's not that it nips a corner of Iowa. It literally goes diagonally across the state.
Amazing.
And so we're getting a large cross-section of people, even though if it just went by a small town of 150 people, there's too much risk associated with this development. And who will be the steward of a pipeline over the rest of its life expectancy?
Has our governor made any much comment about this?
He's stayed fairly neutral so far, but it would be interesting to hear about various pressures that, of course, you know, our state universities. Dave Swenson from Iowa State, who's done an sort of independent audit about the actual economic potential of this pipeline, only creating 2 years worth of jobs, many of which will not come from Iowans because there's not the skilled labor to do this work. Dave Swenson, of course, has been getting pressured from his superiors about speaking out on such an issue. Heaven forbid that we have faculty who are sharing knowledge that isn't influenced by large corporate
thinking.
Just
shut up and teach, Dave. Come on,
right,
what is this?
Right, exactly. So I think we're really seeing a time where we need not only landowners, but we also need students. We need, you know, social workers. We need psychologists to be thinking through this issue about what does it mean when a pipeline runs through your state that your state has not been prepared for. The company only has $250,000 set aside in assets if there's a spill. The Tesoros,
which on the scale of what we're talking about is
pennies.
You know, pennies.
I mean, Steve Jensen's spill is costing tens of millions of dollars to clean up, and they're only in year number two of a supposed 10-year cleanup phase. So this company also is not fiscally responsible to be able to handle this.
Yeah. Time to ask questions, folks. Get together with your neighbors and discuss this. This is important stuff here. You're listening to KHOI FM 89.1. Story City, Ames, and lots of other fine communities. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about the pipeline that just may be out your back kitchen window someplace or your neighbor's kitchen window. There's lots to talk about before something so amazing and possibly dangerous goes in. So let's keep finding out more about that. We are having a wonderful conversation with Taylor, and he's got things to say about Iowa's changing landscape.
So Taylor grew up in North Dakota. He's living in Iowa now, and he's been giving us a kind of an update on what's going on in the Bakken area and what that kind of the oil that's coming through there is going to be traveling through Iowa unless we, as a public community, can decide otherwise. And we've talked about the Pipeline Resistance Coalition because there are many reasons to investigate this and perhaps make a big stink about it, actually. Taylor, do you have anything else that you want to tell us Iowans to help us prepare for the oil economy?
I think it would be really good for listeners to start looking a little bit at North Dakota newspapers, the Bismarck Tribune or Fargo Forum or Dickinson Press.
And online, that's really easy.
Exactly. And listeners can just sort of see for themselves what this oil boom looks like. I mean, daily there are reports in newspapers either about spills or about leakage in the area.
So you're saying this is not well covered by the national press?
This has not been well covered by the national press.
Well, actually, it probably, you know, it's not new news and it gets a little boring.
Right. Last week, Rachel Maddow did have a video about the train derailment, and she's been fairly good about having regular commentary. The New York Times finally had a wonderful two-part investigative series just the other month about the Bakken boom. But, for example, when Steve Jensen's oil spill happened, it didn't make the cover of any national paper. I don't think it was fully covered till I wrote about it in the Huffington Post. But this is not on our radar because corporations, oil companies, have just infected so much of this conversation. It's the largest force on the planet right now.
And everybody is worried about who is going to win an Oscar, I believe.
Right, exactly.
Come on, people.
While they're drinking their sodas.
Some type of beef jerky on the side.
Yeah.
But it is something I think Iowans really can start researching on their own through newspapers, through seeking conversation in North Dakota. The Dakota Resource Council would be a great place for listeners to turn to get some information. But I think now is really the time to be having conversations, because if the IUB approves this pipeline, we ramp up in terms of what the level of conversation.
It's the Iowa Utility Board.
Correct. It ramps up what the conversation will look like in Iowa about this issue. So starting to do some research for any listeners who want to take a trip up to Decorah, I'm speaking at Luther College on Wednesday about the Bakken oil boom at 7 p.m. It's one of those things where I don't think we're getting enough media coverage just about the implications of this. So,
well, Taylor, thank you for telling us all this. And this is an ongoing issue. Through the summer, we'll be in the process publicly with the Iowa Utilities Board. So it's not over in 5 minutes. Hang in there, folks. We'll keep giving you reports.
Right.
And now for a little cheerful news.
Oh, my cheerful news. Not everything is all gloom and doom, right, or even requires a letter to the governor.
We're making a little bit of commercial progress. The Nestle Candy Company, which is a large, large candy company. I'm sure all of us eat some Nestle product or other. It is a Swiss company. They have announced that they are no longer going to use artificial flavors and colorings in their candies. That's none of those FD&C number 3 red or yellow. And apparently it's no big deal. It will taste the same. It'll unfortunately probably have the same amount of calories in it, but it will be a little bit healthier. What a concept. Thank you, Nestle.
Good. So when you're buying your gas and going in there into the convenience store,
get your Nestle's candy bar.
Be aware that we can change. We really can. We can do things differently. We are not really as dumb as you think. So
yeah,
there you go.
And I'm sure that came from consumer pressure. Mm-hmm. And in response, Hershey's gave a sort of a, little more slippery answer, but they did say something about they're going to make their ingredient, you know, when you read on the label, a little more transparent.
Warning labels, yeah.
Yeah. Good. No, it's not a warning label. It's an ingredient list.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know.
So we're making some progress in the civilization. You will now be able to eat a candy without artificial colorants.
That's a good thing to
know.
And
flavors. They're going to use real vanilla.
Good.
Can you imagine that?
Easter candy baskets
coming
up. I'm
sure it will cost them a little bit more, but we'll see if they pass that on to the customer.
Good. Oh, another little short positive thing. My pregnant onion is blooming. And yes, it's called a pregnant onion. It's a houseplant.
How is having baby onions? Can you imagine?
It's a houseplant. And I have also called it a weeping onion, but I looked it up on the website, and it is not a weeping onion. That's a whole different thing. It's called a pregnant onion.
I like the sound of that better than a weeping onion.
Yeah. It's a big, fat, looks like a big green onion, and it sits half in and half out of the dirt. It's one of those wonderful things that doesn't mind being pot-bound, and you can ignore it. And this time of year, it great big long leaves droop out of this thing.
Oh, I know that one.
Yeah.
Those are pretty.
Big, pretty thing. They droop and they sit there all year, really hardy. This time of year, before you know it, look over your shoulder and there's this large stalk. Mine's about 2 feet long. A stalk comes up and a multi-flowered head comes out of this thing.
Is this like a rhubarb-y thing or lovage? They both do that too.
Not quite. It looks more. Oh, it's just tiny, tiny little flowerets that come out of it. Little white and edged with green flowers, and it happens. Long about this time of year, just when you need a little flower happening.
Oh.
It's a harbinger of spring. And another nice little thing.
Oh, any harbinger will do today.
Another nice little thing about these pregnant onions, they multiply by making little bulblets coming off of the side of the big bulb. So it looks like they're crying. Little teardrops form. They drop down. And you can break those off and root them. So a pregnant onion is something that is sort of a joy this time of year. The Latin name is Ornithogallum longdebrachetitum. So,
oh my goodness!
Oh, anyway, it's
a pregnant there.
Onion. It's a nice thing. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with Lana Noctigal
and Donna Prisgintas.
With special guest Taylor Broadby.
Taylor Broadby.
Talking about.
Don't forget that name.
Talking about important things that we should all consider. We've had excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. The music you've heard today is by Alexander Mitchell and Liz Donaldson from their CD called Summer Tunes. It's a great dance album.
Summer tunes. Oh, boy.
Summer tunes. Well,
how about spring tunes? You got one for next week?
Next week we'll bring in another one. Good dance music. I remind you that the Central Arrow Barn Dance is this weekend, February 28th. Roger Alexander calling the Barn Owl Band. Go to CIBD.org.
CentralIowaBarnDance.org.
Listen to the Donna Lana Kitchen live Tuesday at noon, 7 o'clock. KHOI streams. You can download khoifm.org. Eat good food. Enjoy life.